We've been going through, and we'll continue to go through, this theme of an imperfect Lent, which, if you're just joining us, is kind of spawned by the book, The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown, which we have been studying in our Sunday school, and I think we've been getting a lot out of it. And I titled my sermon today, An Imperfect Justification. And it's, you know, it's an imperfect title, is what it is. Didn't like it from when I sent it. I couldn't think of something better, but it's kind of an imperfect deal. And as I was continuing to look at this, the thing that kept coming up in my mind over and over again was the book Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. How many of you have read this book, Catch-22? How many of you got assigned to read it but didn't read it? That was Renee. She got it. She's like, I know I should have read it, but I did not like it. Couldn't get through it. It's a unique book in its tone and in the way that it's written. But it's a book about contradictions. It's where we get the phrase Catch-22, which is kind of a no-win situation. It's a time where any decision you make is going to result in the same bad outcome. And the whole metaphor is set up around the idea of war. The book takes place in Italy during World War II, and the main character, Yossarian, has to keep going on these missions, these flight missions, over and over and over, these bombing raids. And he tries to get out of this, one of the ways that he tries to get out of the army is by claiming that he's crazy. The doctor said, well, if you're crazy, then we can't let you fly missions. And he says, okay, I'm crazy. I said, well, do you want to fly the missions? And he says, no. Well, then you can't be crazy, because only a crazy person would want to fly a mission in which they could be killed. And so he says, okay, well, then I'm not crazy. Well, then you have to fly the missions. Catch 22, he says. That is some catch, that Catch 22. And it goes along like that throughout the book. And what Paul writes out in Romans, in this letter to Romans, he uses the character of Abraham because he's trying to get at this idea of how do we achieve grace? How do we achieve the grace of God, the justification in front of God? And he's putting up this idea of the law or of works, of being able to earn our grace through God. And he says that perhaps Abraham was justified through the law. And of course, at this time, Abraham didn't have the law the way the Jewish people in Paul's time had, right? Abraham did not have the Torah. He didn't have the Ten Commandments. Those things all came later. But rabbis in the time of Paul and even Orthodox Jews today, the way they look at it is they believe that Abraham had the anticipation of the law. He acted as if the law had been written because he was given instruction by God and he followed that instruction the same way that the Jewish people after him followed the law. And so Paul writes and says, okay, can he be justified by these actions? Can he be justified by following the law, however presumptuous it might have been? And so that's what Paul is writing to the Romans. He's writing this out, and we get this sort of very kind of cyclical logic throughout Paul's letter, and it's kind of hard to follow, so I'm going to try to break it down for you. And here's the question that he says. Can we earn grace through righteousness, through following the law, through righteous acts? Can we earn that grace through righteousness? So, in a sense, can we just act perfectly and then receive the grace of God by not doing anything wrong? Now, of course not. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that yes, we can do enough good things to earn our grace. Well, the way Paul puts it is if we are doing enough things to earn grace, then it's no longer grace. Because, like wages, it's earned. And therefore, is not grace. It's as if you had worked a day's work and then your boss came at the end of the day and said, I'm going to give you a gift. Your paycheck. You'd be like, I don't know if that's so much a gift as much as I would have been working hard all day. So then Paul says, okay, well, if, like most of us probably believe, we can't be perfect, right? We can't do enough to earn the grace of God. We can't be righteous all the time. Well, the minute we do something wrong, we are subject to the law. And the law only really has one result for people who do things that are wrong. And that's punishment. That's punishment. And so, in that sense, what Paul is saying is the only way that we can't be punished is if we just didn't have the law to begin with. And then we're right back where we were last week with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, where we have no boundaries, we can just do whatever we want, and we remember how that worked out. Not really well. So the law is important. We need to have the law. It's essential. Paul's not saying we need to abolish the law. And Jesus, of course, said, I have not come to abolish the law, but to reinforce the law. But what do we make of this idea? How then do we get grace? Well, if this is all a little bit too kind of theologically in the weeds for you, I want to give you a practical example. Back when I was at First Baptist Portland, we used to have this program called the Drop-In Program. And we had a commercial kitchen, and we had a staff that ran it. And every Monday and Thursday, we would serve a meal. So they would get there in the morning, make a big meal, hot meal, and then they open up the doors at lunchtime. Anybody who wants to come in, sit down and have a hot meal, no questions asked, come on in. And they served between 200 and 300 people every day. They did that. So I would go down and I would sit with people and I would chat with them and stuff and say, oh yeah, I'm the associate pastor here. And I met one person who said, oh yeah, I know about your church. It's really beautiful. I wish I could go. I said, oh, why can't you go? He says, well, I got some problems. I'm an alcoholic, and I can't get sober, and so until I get sober, I'm not really going to be good enough to come to church. I'm not going to be worthy enough. You know, he had a very high regard for church, and he said, church is not the place for drunks and degenerates like me. It's a place for holy people. I said, well, you clearly haven't been to church then, because we've got no holy people in our church. We've got a few degenerates, a couple alcoholics, but no. But he wouldn't listen. He couldn't hear that. He couldn't get past that idea. And I said, the idea is that you've come to church to help get clean, to help you get sober, to help you find that sense of worthiness. But he couldn't make that change. He couldn't reconcile that. And I think that maybe we don't have that same idea around church, but I think that we probably have that same idea around a lot of other things. Oh, I'm not good enough to do this. I have to lose 20 pounds. I have to pray every day. I have to become a better person. Eat better. Take care of myself better. Then I can go and do such and such. Or then I'll be worthy of such and such. Sometimes we even get this idea with God. I don't want to pray to God right now because I have been screwing up lately and I don't want God to know about it. Or I don't want to face God. Or I don't want to think about prayer life because then I'm going to think about my loved one who has passed on and I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle that grief. I don't know how to bring that to God because I'm angry. God for taking that person. So what is the alternative? How do we deal with this the paradigm of we can't say yes and we can't say no? Well, I'm going to take us back to Catch 22 because he was also, of course, in this impossible situation. Even when he got to a point where he had done what was required, he had met his goal, he was worthy of leaving, he had completed the quota of missions. They just raised the quota. There was no way he could win. And so what did he do? Well, he took himself out of the situation completely. Now, I realize I'm going to give you a spoiler alert, but the book came out in the 60s, so if you haven't read it by now, that's on you. But at the end of the book, Yossarian hears of another soldier, one of his friends, who is Lieutenant Orr. And I think his name is very appropriate, even though it's O-R-R. Orr gives him the alternative. Because Orr has fled successfully to Sweden. And so it gives Yossarian hope. Not hope that he will be able to figure out this dynamic and somehow accomplish it. Not some kind of hope that he'll be worthy enough to go home or that he'll somehow be able to go around this catch-22. But hope that he can escape this situation completely. That this paradigm is just not working. It's contradictory and it's not in his favor. And the only way that he can defeat it is by escaping. So if I was speaking to that man at the drop-in center today, I might say to him, well, if you can't come to church, then try going to an AA meeting. Because the first tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous is not, I have to be worthy, I have to do enough to fix this. The first tenet is, I am powerless to fix this. There is nothing I can do to make this better. By myself. I need a higher power and I need the support of others. It's taking yourself out of that whole paradigm of doing enough to be worthy, being worthy so that you can do more. So this is what this means for us about grace. Because as Paul looks at this catch-22 around Abraham, saying that if he was righteous, if he did enough to earn grace, then that grace would not be earned, and there was nothing that he could do that would necessarily earn it. He says that, in fact, Abraham's righteousness was not given to him by his works. He did not earn it. Nor was it that the things that he did kept him from it. But his righteousness was given to him by faith. Which is to simply say that Abraham received grace because he believed he would receive grace. So when God told him that his descendants would be like the stars of the sky, he believed it. When God told him that his wife, Sarah, who in her advanced age would have a child, he believed it. And then when he was told to sacrifice that child that God would still provide for him, he believed it. And it was his belief, it was his trusting and knowing that was enough. Friends, grace is available to us as well. Grace is available to us as well. As one of the things that we read this week in The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown is that each of us seeks a sense of love and belonging. We all want to feel like we belong. We all want to feel like we are loved. And she says the first step into doing that is to believe that you are worthy of love. That you deserve belonging. And if that is hard to do, to believe that, then believe this. That the grace of God is available to you. That you have something that you cannot earn. Something that you do not deserve, but it's something that is given freely. And with this grace comes the opportunity to be in the presence of God. So what does this mean, that grace is available to you? This is a nice church word. Grace is available to you. And you're like, okay, great. I don't know what that is. That means that you don't have to be worthy of God for God to be with you. You don't have to do something in order to be worthy of God's love, of God's grace. You just have to believe that you will have it, and you will have it. It also means that our faith is not a one-time decision. It's not raising your hand at a revival. It's not even being baptized. It is, faith is an ongoing process. It's a relationship. It's something that we tap into every single day, just as if we talk to ourselves and give ourselves kind of pickups every single day. But just because you tell yourself one day, oh, I am loved and worthy, that doesn't mean that the next day you're not going to have to get up and say to yourself that same thing. The same thing with faith. It's an ongoing process. Every day, you need to get up and remember that we have faith. And it also means this, that our righteousness, our righteous acts, are not a prerequisite of faith. They are a result of faith. One of the gifts that we are given is this idea that when we are in relationship with Jesus, righteousness flows from that. As I told the man at the drop-in center, you need to start going to church so that you can get some. So if grace is available to us all the time, how does this mean that we are to act? What does this mean for our daily lives? Well, it means that if we are given grace, we have to respond with grace. You probably remember the parable of Jesus about the person who was forgiven a large debt and then went and beat his servant for a small debt. Well, if we are to act as God, if we are to represent God in the world, if we are to represent the face of Jesus in the world, we need to be gracious. We need to be gracious to one another, accepting one another, finding the worthiness, not just in our friends, not just in our family and our loved ones, but we need to find worthiness in the people that are really testing our patience. We need to find worthiness in people who don't vote the way we do, don't watch the same cable news programs that we do. We need to find forgiveness one another. We need to find a way of forgiveness without caveats and conditions. It also means that we are gracious when we set boundaries. Oftentimes these conversations of forgiveness will get to a point where we say, well, that means anybody can just do anything they want and we'll have to forgive them. That's not what that means. That means that we are set clear boundaries of what is acceptable and not acceptable to us. But we don't keep so firm on those boundaries that we aren't able to be loving and caring. Brené Brown talks in her book about things that get in the way. This is where she's talking about the things that we are carrying with us that prevent us from loving ourselves, loving one another. In the context of this, I would say that Paul's talking about the things that we are carrying into this conversation that prevent us from being able to find the grace in God and being able to act gracefully with one another. And Brené Brown says that it's often our own shame that is preventing us from doing these things. That when we cannot deal with our own shame, we project it onto others. I'm not good enough. I know I'm not good enough. So I just need to find somebody who's worse than me, and then I'll feel a little bit better about myself. That's not grace. But the good news is that we have this grace available to us today. And this grace is free, and it is abundant. It's not something that we can earn, and it's not something that we can work for. Similarly, we don't have to hold on to our shame. Shame is not something that you can just work off by coming to church. It's not a point system where you get your card punched and you're like, okay, I can be a little bit less ashamed of myself today because I did this, and that. It's something that we just can let go of. This is the whole point of the grace that Paul talks about. The whole point is that you can be forgiven, not because you've earned it, not because you're worthy, but because God is loving and God is giving. And God can forgive you and take away that shame. Because you are chosen. You are a beloved child of God. So believe. Have faith. And take courage. The people of God said,
Amen.
Amen.